Well, welcome, everyone. I think I know almost everyone in the room. There are a couple of unfamiliar faces, but I'm Richard Buck, and it's a pleasure to be teaching for the Institute. And this course is called On Being Human, an exploration into the philosophical anthropology of Martin Buber and Rav Joseph Soloveitchik. And I don't know what you expected when you signed up for the course, other than if you knew me that I'd be here. But you might be wondering, what is philosophical anthropology anyway? Well, the simplest way to explain it is it's everything and nothing. I can explain that best with a story. I was talking to a colleague who was teaching adjunct for us at Mount St. Mary's, where I teach, and he was starting to apply for positions, and he listed as his area of specialization, I think, or area of competence, philosophical anthropology. And I said to him, take that off, because everyone who has a PhD in philosophy does philosophical anthropology. Right. It's on being human, and every philosopher, no matter what a philosopher is studying, is in one way or another exploring some dimension of the human condition. So that also presents a problem for a four-week course, which is, how do you say anything intelligible about being human from a philosophical perspective in four sessions, especially when you're covering thinkers like Martin Buber and Rav Soloveitchik, who each wrote just a little more than 1,000, you know, essays. So it's with that in mind that we start the course. So it'll be in no way covering every single thing, obviously, that Martin Buber or Rav Soloveitchik wrote, but trying to hit what I think are the highlights, just to give everyone a sort of taste of what both philosophers were trying to accomplish in their discussions of philosophical anthropology, the nature of the human being. And although it would appear, and it's interesting, Rav Soloveitchik, one of his books, Ubi Kashtem Lachem, was actually written in response to the existentialist theology that someone like Martin Buber was espousing. However, I think we'll find there are some similarities, although many differences, between their two approaches. So with that in mind, we'll begin with something actually from neither author. If anyone here subscribes to the Weekly Standard, if any of you have heard of that magazine,
yes.
Or you can get this online. There was an essay, I think the title of it was called The Heretic. And it's about a philosopher named Tom Nagel, who's at NYU. I think he's still teaching, probably close to retirement. One of the 20th century's most important philosophers, who's written on, you know, almost everything one a philosopher can write on. An avowed atheist who has written many essays suggesting that there's really no evidence that there is a God, and philosophically speaking, one shouldn't believe in God. But then he writes this book in which he critiques what is called the materialist perspective, which is to say that the materialist perspective is that all there is in the world is material. There's nothing mental. There's no such thing as the mind. So when we're talking about the mind, all we really are talking about is a bunch of neurons firing, the mechanics, the chemistry of the brain. There's nothing beyond the physical. If this is true, that means that everything is determined, and not just in the sense that for every event there is a cause, but that there's no such thing as free will. What we think we're experiencing when there is free will, when we think we're making a choice, is actually could just be reduced down to some kind of biological, chemical, electrical reaction in the brain. Mm-hmm. And that all of our choices, from the very first to the very last, are ultimately determined by genetics, our environment, things beyond our control. Free will is an illusion. The idea of an objective moral order, a moral truth, is an illusion. Nagel attacked all of this. And philosophers whom he's worked with for many years, and he's co-authored pieces with some of these folks, were at a conference somewhere out east, and they were really not just critical of Nagel, but sort of in a fit over this, because they believe that he's gone off the deep end, and he's misleading people in a very dangerous way, misleading people into believing that there is such a thing as an objective moral order, there's such a thing as free will, that this is immature thinking, and that while it might be difficult for us to deal with this, we ought to just recognize the fact that we are nothing more than material things. That's just what we are. it's really the case that Martin Buber and Rav Soloveitchik years before are really trying to disprove this same idea. And there is quite a bit at stake in this, because it is true that if there's nothing more to being human than just a certain ordering of biological, chemical, electrical processes different than non-human animals, then again, the idea of the human conscience is a myth. The idea of the human conscience is without support, and our belief in it is a sign of our reluctance to recognize the truth. So one might ask the question, should we take our time thinking about this? Why should philosophers spend their time writing these, as we'll see, and you'll see from the handouts, using this very difficult language and trying to capture these very elusive notions? Because there is something very important at stake here. And what both Martin Buber and Rav Soloveitchik are trying to establish is that this view of human beings as really nothing more than a concatenation of chemical, biological, and electrical events is wrong. What I like to ask my students is, and I teach at Catholic University, most of them are not materialists, although they think they are. And I'm not sure why they think they are or want to be, but they're really not. But when they push this line, I say to them, well, explain this. How does this gray ball of mush, which is your brain, how does it generate a morality, a conscious life, a conscience? How does that happen? If all we are is just electrical events going on in this thing, how does that generate what we call conscience? How does it generate all of the ideas we have about obligation and duty, responsibility, love, emotion, all of these things? So if we can buy into what Martin Buber and Rav Soloveitchik are trying to do, this will go some way to helping us address this. And unfortunately, it is the case that, I don't know what the percentages are, I haven't done a survey, but there are many philosophers who are materialists, who think that, the kind of things that Martin Buber was exploring and Rav Soloveitchik was exploring, that this is really clearly in the realm of theology. It's also completely wrong-headed. It's fantasy. It's really literature. I went to grad school with people like this who would look at this work and say, that's literature. It's bad literature because it's hard to understand and it's depressing and everything else, but it's nothing. It doesn't tell us anything about the human condition. So there is something important at stake in investigating these questions. So with that, we'll go ahead and begin. We'll start with Martin Buber and just a little bit of background on Buber's life. 1878 to 1965 are his years. He was born in Vienna, spent most of his life with his grandparents. His grandfather was actually a very famous Midrash scholar named Solomon Buber. He engaged in advanced secular studies at the University of Vienna. He actually focused much of his work on the philosophies of Kant and Nietzsche. We'll probably talk about Kant a bit, probably not much about Nietzsche. Not that he's not interesting, but maybe in one of the latter sessions. He wrote his dissertation under the direction of Hermann Cohen, the University of Berlin. Interestingly, Hermann Cohen was the subject of Rav Soloveitchik's dissertation. Kind of an interesting link there. Hermann Cohen was a neo-Kantian, an exponent contemporary at the time of Kant's philosophy, and Rav Soloveitchik wrote on his Metaphysics and Epistemology. We'll talk about what both of those things mean in a few minutes. Eventually, he had to flee Europe, obviously, when the Nazis came to power, and he was not allowed eventually not to teach. 1938 is when he emigrated to Palestine. He actually began teaching at Hebrew U. And one of the things he's most noted for, aside from his writings, was that he became very active in a group in the 1940s called Yichud, which was its aim was to create a joint Arab-Jewish state. So Buber wrote voluminously, and again, as I mentioned before, one of the challenges is trying to figure out how in four sessions, or really two sessions, if you think half of each is devoted to Martin Buber, how do you talk about Martin Buber's philosophy of the human being? So, we'll do our best. I draw your attention to the first statement on the handout. And this really is a nice way of explaining for Buber what he was focusing on in what he called philosophical anthropology. So look at all the things that he mentions there. And you can see why this is a daunting task. The special place of human beings in the cosmos, the idea of destiny and our connection with it. What is it and how are we connected with it? Our relationship to the world of things, et cetera, et cetera. Encounters with others. We're going to talk about some of these things in latter sessions, but you see how broad this is and why. It's really proper to say that everyone who studies philosophy, really, even if you don't go on to get a PhD in it, if you read philosophy, you're doing philosophical anthropology, because it's just what it is to be human. And in one way or another, you're studying one dimension of this. Now, Buber was very critical of any attempt to reduce the study of human being down to one specific discipline or sub-discipline of philosophy. That's the statement in number two on your sheet, A2, section 8, number 2. He talks about this as narrowing the focus unnecessarily and actually obscuring things, and in the end, dehumanizing. As we'll see this when we go on in future sessions in our discussion of Buber, that any attempt to overly categorize something, to try to boil things down to their most basic elements, you're removing something important. And that means that the task of exploring what a human being is incredibly difficult, because our intention, our plan, the way we operate is to try to categorize things. That's the way we do it. We try to break things down. Whether we're talking about people, whether we're talking about objects in the world, whether we're talking about a job that we're going to take, a person we might want to marry, we typically find ourselves trying to figure out, you know, the small details. Okay, how can I break this down into the most simplest explanation, whether it should be a yes or a no? Should I engage with this person or not? Should I buy this or not? Should I attend this school or not? And Buber says, look, if only it could be that simple. But if you do that, you're actually removing a lot of what's involved in understanding what you're encountering. And we'll see this especially when we talk in a later session about his classic work, I and Thou. Mm-hmm. So for Buber, although if you look at his work, at just some of the passages I gave you, you'd think it's the contrary. He actually thinks in order to understand human beings, we got to focus on the concrete. Now, you might say, after reading Buber, the last word that comes to mind is concrete. You know, he uses all these terms, and it's not even clear what he's talking about. Relation to and experience with and the encounter, the I, the you, it seems anything but concrete. But what Buber thinks he's doing is actually exploring what it is we are experiencing when we encounter something else in the world. So even though the language is abstract and obscure, what he thinks he's doing is really focusing on the bits and pieces of our experience every day, what we are experiencing in its naked reality, without any analysis. This is what we are experiencing. One of the things that Buber says that's perhaps most important is that, and again, here we go with our very first indication of how, you know, non-concrete his language is that human beings are the only being with the capacity for potentiality. Whereas non-human things are, in one sense, actual. They are what they are. Human beings are potential. At no point in anyone's life can you get a sense, I know what this person is, because at any point in time, it could change. Now, some philosophers thought this was true of the world as a whole. Plato famously claimed in The Republic that the reason we could have no knowledge, strictly speaking, of the visible world is that everything is constantly in a state of flux. And that's because nothing in the physical world bears its predicates in an unqualified way. So, for example, if I ask you whether this watch is large or small, the answer is?
It depends.
It depends. If you hold it next to me, it's small. If I put it next to an ant, it's large. And that's true for every property of everything in the world. So Plato argued you can only have knowledge of things in what he called the intelligible realm. Well, Buber thinks that really when it comes to things in the world, human beings are the only thing that are really undefinable as they are right now in any given moment. So that's why he says we have potentiality. In a sense, you know, we could say we're unpredictable. That's how Buber accounts for evil and free will, is that we can become anything. And we'll talk in a later session about his view of evil and how we are redeemed from evil. So the basic idea is that our actions are unforeseeable. You really cannot predict what a human being is going to do. And again, we would like to be able to do this. We think the world would be a much simpler place if we could predict what people would do. And in fact, there are sciences that try to do this, or at least try to determine how to prevent certain things from happening, right? Raise our children in a certain way, educate them in a certain way, and they're less likely to do X, Y, or Z. But the truth is, even the best psychologists will tell you, that these are really just theories, that there are always exceptions, because every person, every child is unique. So it's interesting. We come up with theories, but if you try to apply one to an individual person, you know, a psychologist is likely to say, well, you can't really do that because every person is unique. And yet we have theories. We want to theorize, we want to categorize, but it's very difficult to do that. That's just our nature. We have to recognize that, and it's very important to recognize it not only about ourselves, because it's interesting, in ourselves, we see this unforeseeability as a wonderful thing. The sky's the limit. Nothing is limiting me. I mean, this is what, you know, we tell our students to think of themselves in this way. But it's a much more daunting idea when it comes to looking at other people this way. Because what we would really like is if we could do almost anything, but we knew exactly what everyone else was going to do. That would make life much easier for us. But that obviously is not the case. And I should say, so I've already been talking for 20 minutes straight, if there are any questions, comments, anything in one of the passages that sounds crazy or really wonderful and you want to respond to it, please raise your hand, shout it out. Go right ahead. Yes.
One question that Nagel, you talked about, that
yes.
Everything is material, we're just like everything else. So is he really doing this philosophical anthropology, because he's not treating a human being any different than anybody else?
Well, he is. He has now come around, and in his book, and I'm sorry, I can't remember the name of it, but if you just Google the article, you'll get it, because it was a few issues back in the Weekly Standard.
What's his first name?
Thomas Nagel. And he is arguing against this view. He's saying it's wrong. In fact, in part of the book, he's arguing against it. And that's why he's being called a heretic, because he's betrayed this school of philosophy that he's been part of for so long. And he actually wrote one of his most famous essays. I mean, most of what he's written becomes, you know, close to a philosophy bestseller, because it's just the kind of mind he has. It's called Moral Luck. You can probably get this. It's probably available somewhere online. I can get a copy for you if you'd like. And it's an essay on the very possibility of making moral judgments. Because when we think about any action we've committed, you realize that behind that action is a whole series of events and causes we had no control over. So one of the examples he gives is, you know, someone who was a, you know, unfortunately a war criminal probably wouldn't have been that had this person been born in another part of the world or at another time. Had there not been a war. Everything was is not really within our control. All these things that were essential for something to occur, even for a choice to happen, for a choice to be available, are not within our control. And that's what we talk about moral luck, that, you know, some people have moral good luck. You know, they're always in the right place at the right time, wonderful opportunities available to them, they always do the right thing because they have the right background, and other people always seem to have moral bad luck.
Nothing is ascribed to the individual's stuff.
Well, that's in that essay, he sort of leaves it open. Look, we have to recognize this, and I use it in my moral philosophy class, the first thing the students read, and I say, we're going to try to show how you can respond to this throughout the course, know that we are morally responsible, because no one wants to say, oh yeah, well then let's just throw out moral responsibility. Let's say that there isn't any. We can't blame anyone for anything. Just say it's all bad luck. Or if you're a materialist, look, it's just your genetics. It's just how things have happened.
If you're a materialist, does that mean you're still a philosophical anthropologist?
Yes.
Because a person is just no different than a...
Correct.
Anything else, so why do you call it...
It's what Rob Soloveitchik will call the modern scientific view. Uh-huh. Right? But that's your view of the human being. We just have to recognize this. We're really no different than anything else in the natural world.
You mentioned literature before as one of the disciplines which has a perspective on this.
Yes.
I just wondered, are you familiar with Malam as the Assistant?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. It works it out to a T. He even calls that major character of his Morris Bober.
Yeah, oh, that's right. I remember that now, yeah.
And the whole thing plays out that way, and he's committed to the notion of a person being able to change, but not by himself. It has to be in relationship to other people.
Right.
Which I believe is...
That's right. That's one of Buber's hallmarks. Yeah. That's right.
So two things. Are we nature versus nurture, is what you're saying? And also, we're nothing of everything or everything of nothing. Because if he believes we're nothing, we're just. But again, at the same time, if you pick apart an action to different pieces, you can't leave anything out. Therefore, we're everything also, which is.
Well, we're not the according to this view that we're just materialists, or we're just material things.
Buber's view is that you said you can't leave one part out without the other part, and figuring out how to.
You can't reduce an individual, a thing, really anything, to a small part. Everything has to be, in order to understand the world around you. Okay. The attempt to categorize things, especially the human being, which is mm-hmm. going to be our focus today, you can't break us down to any particular aspect of being human. If you do that, you're going to leave something out, right? And we are unpredictable. There's always this possibility of change, of development, being something other than what we are right now. And that's why there's really no way of predicting what any human being will become. Okay, so one of the things that Buber rejects, which is a very common view, especially in the Greek philosophical tradition, and even beyond, into, for example, Kant was someone who defended this view as well, but he wasn't by any means the only one, is the idea that human beings are basically rational animals, or at least that reason is our most important feature, because it's what distinguishes us from non-human beings. Right? So Aristotle, for example, thought all living things have souls, but only human beings have reason, or actually, only some human beings, because women were not fully rational, according to Aristotle. You can leave that aside, but this is what he said. So Buber wants to, and this is in section A, number 3 in the Buber section, the third passage there, where he argues against this. And, you know, in that, it's a longer passage. I'm not going to read the whole thing. But if you look at what he says about the third line down, he can be understood only when he knows, on the one hand, that there is something in all that is human, including thought, which belongs to the general nature of living creatures and is to be grasped from this nature, while knowing, on the other hand, there is no human quality which belongs fully to the general nature of living creatures and is to be grasped exclusively from it. Even man's hunger is not an animal's hunger. Human reason is to be understood only in connection with human non-reason.
So he needs the thesis and the antithesis, which is what I heard this morning with Soloveitchik, is very much the dialectic.
Yes, so what we'll see is that Rob Soloveitchik is trying to bring together both the Greek view, the biblical view, or one understanding of the biblical view of human beings, and the modern scientific view. He doesn't want to reject either one.
So you're saying this is instinct versus rationality, because animals have instinct.
Correct.
And they therefore behave, eat, kill, have next generations through instinct.
Yes.
While humans have a rationality, where we eat not just because we're hungry, you know.
That's right. But Buber wants to say we can't boil this all down to understanding human beings as what we are because of reason. Right? We are something, but it's not simply because we're rational. There's more to us than that. Even though, again, the dominant view has been that's what distinguishes us from the rest of the natural world. Mm-hmm. So two important components of, or the principle, what Buber calls the principle of human life. This is in now section B, the very first passage. There are two what he calls basic movements. The first one is the primal setting at a distance. And the second is entering into relation. So Buber says setting at a distance, which we're about to explain, is what shows how human beings are possible. I apologize, in the passages, it is, the word man is used. I wasn't going to change it. That's what Buber uses. If I was writing this, I'd be using other language. But anyway, that's what's there. So,
So I'm sorry, what did you say?
Setting at a distance. This shows how human beings are possible as what we are. So what does it mean to set? What is he talking about when he says setting something at a distance? We have to do this before we can enter into relation. So one example of, or one way to explain this is to mm-hmm. think about what an animal does. And this is in B, section B, this the mm-hmm. third passage. So animals have realms, but human beings have worlds. So what's the difference between a realm and a world? So a realm is where, if you look in the passage, an animal just selects, as Perry said, based on instinct, what the animal needs, but doesn't see it as part of anything beyond itself, right? I mean, maybe it doesn't even see it as part of itself. It just acts on instinct, grabs what it needs, takes it, uses it, eats it, etc. But even when we take something in the world, when we identify something, we try to understand it not just as what it is for us, but what it is as part of the world, because we recognize that in taking something from the world, in interacting with the world, we're doing something to ourselves. It's part of what we are. We understand that it's, in a sense, an unfolding of our identity. Every time we take something from the world, use a tool, build a home, speak with another person, do anything in the world, part of our identity is unfolding. That's not true for non-human animals. So, although an animal, another example, although an animal is in a way concerned with its future, right? Animals will collect food for their young and will obviously have offspring, but only the human being can actually imagine its future. And Buber has a wonderful line. He says, "The beaver's dam is extended in a time realm, but the planted tree is rooted in the world of time," right? Because human beings have a world, non-human animals only have a realm. "He who plants the first tree is he who expects the Messiah." Because we, in planting a tree, right, and obviously Mashiach is our ultimate destiny, so even in the act of planting a tree, that points ahead, right? We're thinking, what does this mean for the future? We're always thinking about this. An animal doesn't think beyond its basic needs, even though what it is doing is enabling it to live into the future. An animal doesn't recognize that. And it's not making worlds. There's a well-known book by a philosopher in the 1970s about theory of knowledge, but it's called Ways of World Making. It's describing our, in particular, use of language, but that what we're doing is we're making worlds. Non-human animals don't do that. We create a world for ourselves, as is everyone else around us, when we act in the world. And of course, part of the difficulty is coming into relation with people when we are all doing that, because we're creating worlds of our own, and how do we bring these together? One thing to keep in mind, it's a way of actually bridging or showing a commonality between Rav Soloveitchik and Martin Buber, is that the only way we can relate to anything, there has to be some commonality there. There has to be something that we share. Because if you think about it, how do we relate to something that is entirely and in every way unlike us? How would that happen? How would such a connection ever occur? There's got to be something, even the smallest thing that we share.
I thought Aristotle said the person is a big ball and two halves. When they find their mate, they make one whole. There's a philosopher that I remember learning. You know what I'm talking about?
It sounds that you were first describing Aristotle's idea, not that the soul is a ball, but that you could picture the soul that way with two halves and then two halves in each half. But I don't remember. I don't know. I mean, I don't recall him saying something like that. But it's possible that in his more lyrical moments, maybe he did that.
Is something social, or even when we're using when you say there, when you were interacting, we're making our own world. Does that include using the material things in the world, or just social people?
Yeah, so animals would just sort of, they don't recognize that everything in the world is already there as a part of something larger than itself. Non-human animals don't realize this. We recognize this. And actually, there's a normative component to this. We ought to recognize this.
Behavior and consequence.
Mm-hmm. Well, we ought to recognize that there is a world out there and that we are impacting it. We are creating a world with everything
we're
do.
Affecting the world.
And that's something important to keep in mind when we think about what our relationship to the natural world should be. How should we relate to the world around us? Because we are impacting it, we're creating a world in everything that we do.
Evelyn. It's interesting also in literature, and I can speak from Jewish and Jewish American literature, the individuals who are described as almost soulless and taking just for what they want and need, don't understand the animals, are also described as animals.
That's fitting. Yeah, Buber would agree with that, because it's something we should be able to do. We should recognize that what we take is part of the world around us. When we engage in the world in any dimension, in any way, we are creating a world.
Right. But is that behavior as I said before, inherent, or is it learned? Or is it learned? You know, people go through traumas who. Children who go through traumas of losing a parent or something, a child, all of a sudden looks for and starts acting like they just want to survive. We have to then teach them how to understand that their survival impacts others. You know, so is it nature, as again, nature versus, you know, nature versus nature.
It's possible that people could, a human being could fail to have this ability to recognize that in engaging in the world, you're actually creating a world. That's certainly possible. That's why I say there's a normative element to this, that Martin Buber is arguing we ought to recognize this is what we are doing. It's how we are possible as a human being, why we're not just non-human animals. Why we are human is because we have the capacity to do this. We have worlds, and non-human animals just have realms.
So then he would argue with Nagel then. So Nagel, the earlier Nagel says that we're just neurons firing off and everything. But yeah,
yes, absolutely. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, Buber's not a materialist. Now, again, it doesn't mean that we are separate entirely from the natural world. That was one view we'll see, and Rav Soloveitchik addresses this. That's not how we should understand ourselves either. We are fully enmeshed in the world, but we have to recognize that our being in the world is a much different way of being in the world than it is for a non-human animal.
Right. You have a range, though.
Among human beings. Well, you know, if you think about when I talk to my students about what it means to live a good life, mm-hmm. One way of describing it, if we were reading Buber, you could say that the person who focuses solely on, you know, acquiring material goods and making a lot of money, be nothing beyond that, you're either making a really small world, you're falling well short in your ability, or you're not doing that at all. You're really no more than a non-human animal. You're taking only what you need. And you're not thinking about creating something mm-hmm. beyond that. Mm-hmm. And that would be a failing. So yes, it's possible for human beings to fail in this and fail badly. But we have to recognize this, and that's why there is that normative dimension. It's what we ought to be doing.
And I think the Holocaust appears also in examples of what we're talking about, of what you do, what you take, why you take. And if I'm not mistaken, I thought Soloveitchik referred to it.
It's certainly possible. One of the criticisms of, or the, in analyzing the Shoah is to say, well, this was a, you know, the I don't think this is actually correct, but it's like the extreme abuse of human reason, right? Over rationalizing,
yeah, right.
And that this is the extreme. This is what it's taken to. I don't think that's actually right, but it clearly you see a kind of a failure to see, well, what Buber would call the I-thou, as we'll see, right?
Mm-hmm.
The relation
mm-hmm.
to others that, and they could, you could see how this would, how this could affect not only relation to other human beings, but non-human animals, etc. Although, you know, what they say about some of these, the Nazis, Yimach Shamam, is that they would go home and, you know, they love dogs, they love their families.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And,
yeah, yeah.
You know,
yeah,
so.
They were sympathetic to their dogs.
It's hard to understand, yeah, what. Yes. Yes.
What about, like, I don't know, I think this has happened where people have been raised by animals, like the wolf. Is that a true story or is that made up?
I've heard these stories.
Because you wonder if a human being is raised just in a company of animals, would he have that perspective of an animal? Like, is it part
well,
of
the so this gets to the second dimension of the, yeah. the second part of the principle of life is relation to others.
Right.
And ultimately, Buber argues that what we most want is recognition from other human beings.
Uh-huh.
And all human beings want that. So I guess he would argue that eventually, even someone, if you can imagine someone just as a thought experiment,
right.
raised with non-human
wolves,
beings,
for example,
wolves or whatever,
yeah.
that eventually, as a human being, you will want that recognition from other human beings. You will seek it out eventually, right? This is,
yeah,
and again,
yeah.
this gets back to, I think this is an idea that Martin Buber would accept. And again, given how voluminous, it's hard to know. I can't say that in my research I found this idea, but this question about the nature of the human will, right? So one might think that free will means we're free to do anything. Even not to be happy, and I think not to seek happiness. And I think that I mean, the way I see it, and I think Martin Buber would see it this way as well, is that no, we are restless for something. We want something. Now, Martin Buber would say what we most want is recognition from others. Rav Soloveitchik will say, for example, in Uvikashtem Lachem, we most want union with Hashem. That's what we most, that's what we, our will yearns for this, and it's unavoidable, right? This is not, we cannot choose not to want this. Ultimately, this is what we want. Dr. We want that union with God. That's what we seek.
Dr. Buck, I remember distinctly in the Lonely Man of Faith, Soloveitchik saying very clearly what we want from other men is recognition that
right.
we exist. So I guess they're in agreement
that's,
here.
That's right. That's a similarity. We most want this. So Buber would say, every human being is eventually going to seek this. And that's this is part of the second dimension, right? The first one was primal setting at a distance, setting things out. And also now, once you've set them out, trying to find relation with them. So you can think about it this way. In creating our world, now we want to try to find our place in it, right? And, you know, as I talk about with my students, you hear this phrase, I guess not so much anymore, the midlife crisis, you know, man buys a sports car, 50, you know. Well, what causes that? I mean, that's not the right reaction to it, of course, but what causes that? Well, because you wake up one day and you realize, I don't know what I've done with my life. I've created this world and I don't see how I'm connected to it at all. I think about I always like to bring popular culture into my classes, so the Talking Heads song Once in a Lifetime, there's a refrain in there which says something like, you wake up and you say, this is not my beautiful house, this is not my beautiful car, this is not my beautiful wife, my God, what have I done? You know, you just realize this is, I can't relate to any of this, right? So the second part of this principle of life is, now that we've created a world, we have to try to find some way to connect with it. And if you can't do it, that's probably what causes a midlife crisis, right? That's when life is in crisis, you realize, this is the world I've created, I can't connect with it.
I think there's more of that than ever. We just
use
the term midlife.
Yeah, I don't know what term we use now, but there probably is more of that than ever. And, you know, it's, again, creating the wrong kind of world, right? Instead of focusing on all that we should as human beings, all that we're possible, all that we are capable of, I should say, we limit ourselves to, you know, these, and this could arise again out of the attempt to try to bring everything down to its most basic element, understand everything as simply as possible, but then you realize that you've overlooked so much, and then you've created a world that is either too basic or is completely, you can't, I mean, just imagine what that feeling must be like. I mean, God willing, none of us will ever experience this, but it's got to be tremendously frightening. You've created a world that you can't connect with.
Incidentally, I don't know how my husband and I were talking about this today. You know,
he's not having a midlife crisis, is he?
I hope not.
He looks pretty good to me, so I don't know.
The thing is, like, whenever, let's say you're going through life and you're saying, oh, you know, I got all this money, I got this car, I got this, and then say, well, I'm going to try getting this, I'm going to try getting that. So the ultimate book to address that is King Solomon, because he tells you, I had it all, okay, and it wasn't enough. So
right.
You don't have to go through getting the wives and the horses and this and this and the other thing. All you read is what he said. He says, look, I had it. You know, not that we learned from somebody else. Because we go from one stage to another. Oh, I have to have kids. Oh, I have to have cars.
This is why you got to stay awake during Kohelas. Even though it's long, don't fall asleep during Kohelas. Seriously. You miss a lot if you do. You miss the whole point of everything.
Yeah.
Yes.
If you fall asleep during that.
So that's basically what we all go through, is that we feel an emptiness. One space leaves, the kids leave home, then you go to the next thing. And then that stage gets you to it, and then that leaves, and you know, so then you see, you know.
You're trying to find this connection.
You find, yeah.
So, how do we realize ourselves as human beings? Well, this is the second dimension. This is entering into relation. So, again, using an example of a non-human animal. An animal makes use of a stick as a tool. But again, we set it aside. After we've used it, we now identify it as something that fits the world that we have created. And in that way, we are creating a relation with it, right? So and this is an interesting way of thinking about the way we should make use of the natural world around us, right? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Because what are we doing when we waste things? We're taking things, but now there's nothing to do with them. We use it once, we throw it away. We've been unable to create a world in which we need that. So the proper use of the natural world is one in which we take what we need and we're able to figure out what its place is going to be in our life. Now that sounds, I take a gallon of milk and I got to think about, well, no, I mean, obviously those are basic needs. But when you, build a house, when you take a job, when you buy things, when you create something, anything that requires you engaging in the world outside of you, you should recognize this is something that is part of the world I've created. What is it going to mean for me? What part of me does it define? What does it say about me? When we are unable to do that, we've wasted something because it's obviously nothing that we can use. The best example of this, one clear way that we imprint ourselves on things is through art. It's a very interesting way to think about what art is. What for Buber is, it's the origin of art, is this relation, our attempt to find relation with things. So it's not simply our attempt to classify the world, right? That's not what an artist is doing. I mean, that you could say maybe that's why so much art is abstract, because mm-hmm. if an artist was simple, I mean, obviously there's realistic art, which is quite good, but there's also art that's not realistic, and you wonder, what was Picasso thinking when he painted this stuff? You go look at the Art Institute in Chicago, the black canvas. This is the black canvas. What is it supposed to? Well, this is an attempt by the artist to relate to the world around him or her, right? His or her idea of the world upon it.
So this kind of overlaps with psychology then. A lot of what you're saying overlaps a little bit with psychology. Because a child will use art to express what's going on in the family. Like a child psychologist would use art if the child draws a big father or a small mother, things like that, to express how she's doing. So when you're saying a lot of stuff, the philosophy overlaps with psychology. Would that be the case, or?
I think you can. There is one of the nice things about philosophy is that there is quite a bit of overlap. I mean, philosophers, try to get their hands into everything, but do talk about things like psychology because you can see the overlap there. And this is something that, I mean, Buber is in some ways a psychologist, right? He's trying to explore the human mind, and this is art is a product of the human mind. What are we doing? We're trying to express a relation to the world around us. That's what the artist is at root trying to do in creating art. That's the origin of the work of art. So those are the two dimensions. Again, setting things aside and then building a relationship with what we've created. This is the creating of the world, the thing that non-human animals can't do. I can see we're moving right along. So I'm going to try to tie this up and then get to at least part of what I wanted to say tonight about Rav Soloveitchik. There'll be a bit of overlap into the second class, but that's okay. This is makes me feel right at home because this is what typically happens in my classes anyway. And I always tell my students falling behind is not a bad thing because it means we're having lots of good discussion. So I mentioned this before. Mutual confirmation is what we all seek. And this is when that second stage, that second part of the principle, building relation, is completed. It's when we find mutual confirmation with other human beings. And one way we do this is through speech, according to Buber. So animals obviously non-human animals call to one another, right? We hear them, these sounds all around us. But we, according to Buber, we speak to others, only human beings do this, as independent beings. So what does this mean? What is he saying? It's dialogue, right? Non-human animals don't really have dialogue. Now, again, this is not to disparage non-human animals, and there are animal biologists who claim that, some species are quite advanced and we don't give them enough credit. But clearly there's something unique about what we're able to do. And you think about it, we are able to create dialogue, right? And what is the purpose of dialogue? Well, one could look at it in a very basic way as well. It's just a way of getting the things that we want, right? So a materialist would say, dialogue is an evolutionary adaptation. It's a way of surviving in the world. We've evolved from our earliest ancestor, whichever homo it was, who had maybe some kind of grunting interaction, and we've, mm-hmm. what happened? Well, eventually through these spontaneous mutations or something, those creatures that were able to articulate more complex utterances survived, those who weren't able to didn't, mm-hmm. and eventually we evolved into the kind of being we are. But basically this is a evolutionary adaptation that makes our lives easier in the world. That's what it is. Buber says, no, dialogue is the way we confirm each other. Right? I mean, think about it. Right. What's the essence of a good marriage? Conversation. You got to talk to each other. You have to communicate. You have to open yourself up to someone else. But recognizing, as we'll see, it's not possible to really understand what another person is experiencing because it's always unique. Right? You can't get into another person's body and then experience what, or mind, and experience what that person is experiencing.
Right.
But dialogue is essential. If you don't have conversation, you can't have a relationship. So the culmination of this second part of the principle of life, this coming into relation, is dialogue. And we'll see this, and I think it's the third session, our relationship with others, where we'll focus on the I, thou, Buber's book, I and Thou, and in particular, his understanding of how we are to come into this relation with Hashem. Because it's very different than, here's where you see a divergence with Rav Soloveitchik. So let's go on, let's go to Rav Soloveitchik now, and again, I'm not going to rush through this, we'll try to make up some ground in the next session. So as I mentioned, it was about 40 minutes ago, I just wanted to mention again, because it's an interesting connection, that Rav Soloveitchik wrote his PhD dissertation on the Hermann Cohen, who was whom Martin Buber was a student of. So for Rav Soloveitchik, he says there are three basic approaches to understanding the human being: the biblical, classical Greek, and the modern scientific. Now, the biblical and classical Greek view are similar in that they both see human beings as incongruous with nature. They ascribe to human beings a unique status. From the biblical account, it's we are created by and therefore endowed with some part of a transcendent God. And for the Greek conception, it's that we have reason and the faculty of reason, we have intellect. That's what distinguishes us. This is, by the way, is in the section of the handout of Rav Soloveitchik. This is in section B. It's the second. It's number two. If you go back, actually, to the in the section of the handout of Rav Soloveitchik, number one there, under aims and focus, it lays out his program, what he's trying to accomplish. He had actually written this is from a letter to, as it says, Rabbi Leonard Rosenfeld, who there was a connection. I think he was actually got smicha from Rabbi Soloveitchik's father, I think. I may have gotten that wrong, but there is a connection there. But Rav Soloveitchik also wrote a pamphlet. I've tried to find it, and I can't. I haven't been able to locate it yet, but called The Doctrine of Man. Mm-hmm. But it became eventually, I think, this book, The Emergence of Ethical Man. But if you look at what he says in that passage, he says his interest is in religious anthropology, the doctrine of man, within the philosophical perspective of Judaism. It's no one's really been doing this. It's original. It's a unexplored territory.
Is it true?
I think at the time he was writing, at least from his perspective, yes, in the unique approach he's going to take, which is an attempt to bring together the biblical, classical Greek, and modern scientific conception of human beings. Try to show that you can meld them into one, or at least combine them into a view that fits with the Judaic perspective, or that he'll call the Judaic perspective. Mm-hmm. So the modern scientific view of human beings is what we've been describing as the materialism, is that human beings are just part of nature. The only difference between us and an animal is that we're more complex. We have a higher degree of diversity. Our life processes are different, more organized than non-human animals. That's the only difference. Spirituality, again, it's not there. There's no such thing as the mental. There's only the material. And evolution. Now, interestingly, Rav Soloveitchik will want to argue that the only reason evolution is a problem, evolutionary theory is a problem, is if you take an incorrect view of the human being. And it's the view that he's going to explore in a second. He distinguishes now, when talking about the biblical view, the Jewish, or the Judaic, and the Christian view. Mm-hmm. The Christian view is problematic because they viewed human beings as on a different plane than the rest of the natural world. Now, what's interesting is Rav Soloveitchik says, if you look at the account in Bereishis, the creation of the world, the creation of human beings, as he reads it, we are in the same, we are on the same plane as the natural world. We are not distinct from it, at least not in the way that Christian theologians thought we were. So that's his criticism of, or argument against, the Christian view of, the Christian biblical approach. So the Rav argues, and this, if you look at B4, this is on page 2 of the last passage there, he'll argue that we are to be understood properly as a part of nature, a unique part of nature, but that we possess, even though we possess consciousness, it doesn't mean we are distinct from or separate from. So he rejects this kind of what he calls separatism in an understanding of human beings. We are a part of nature. We are not wholly separate and distinct from it. One way he begins to prove this is by looking at the account of the creation of the world. And he says, everything in the world that Hashem creates has a common origin. It's earth. Obviously, the common origin is Hashem, but everything comes from the earth. Just look at the name of the first human being,
Adam,
right? It means earth, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, this is where we create. And the fact that when we die, we return to the earth, right? We return to our origin. So this is one way. I mean, it's a much more lengthy discussion in many different works, but this is one way of showing that if we read correctly the account of creation in Bereishis, we see we're not distinct from nature. There's a commonality there. Now, obviously, we are, as Rav Soloveitchik puts it, we are ontically very simple, meaning in sense of what we are, our being, the thing that we are, but ethically we are much more complex. That's where things get complicated, and that's why this book is called The Emergence of Ethical Man. Right. Well, if we are just like the rest of the natural world, then the question arises, well, where does moral obligation come from? Our sense of duty, our understanding of ethics, where does this all come from? It doesn't apply to the rest of the natural world. How do we emerge out of this to develop this idea of moral obligation, a moral worldview? Where does it come from? And that's what he's going to try to explain. We'll hopefully get to that in future sessions. One of the things, interestingly, that Rav Soloveitchik tries to show is that we, if you look at our similarity to part of the natural world, we are very similar to plants. It's something that you wouldn't have thought of, you know, like, I know some people talk to their plants, but the idea that we would find this commonality. But he says, well, both plants and human beings are complex structures that interact with their environment. And we, like plants, engage in, at least in part, the same kind of non-conscious functioning, right? Just like plants are not self-conscious, obviously, we are. But part of us also is a non-self-conscious functioning, right? Just like the plant. Yeah, that's right. So there is this similarity. And again, going back to something Buber had talked about, trying to think of how we can connect with, relate with things outside. There's got to be some commonality. Think about the fact that we're able to digest things. Yeah. Right? So we have a pharmacist in the class. I mean, there's got to be something that allows us to do this. If you think about it, I mean, this is not that philosophers sit around thinking about it while we're able to digest things. But if you think about it, we can take something that's not us, that's foreign to us, put it in our bodies, and our body is able to not only pass it through and actually it doesn't kill us, but actually it helps us. Certain things we eat are not good for us, but other things we eat are actually help us. They help us grow. They're essential to us, but they're not part of us. There's got to be a commonality there, something that we share. And I think this is at the heart, or at least part of what the Rav is getting at, is that it's clear, but obviously he's first trying to establish the theological grounding for this, and he thinks it's squarely in the appropriate reading of the story in Bereishis. Yes. Yeah. Now, we're going to talk later in the next session about eating animals and Rav's take on this. Mm-hmm. Since animals are part of the natural world, obviously, how we're supposed to react to this. At the end of this first part of The Emergence of Ethical Man, the Rav goes into a detailed halachic analysis of the fetus and the goses. The goses is the patient in a coma. Right? What he's trying to show there is that we have, even without consciousness, we still have, as a fetus, let's say, and as a person in a coma, we still have a juridic status, right? A status that we have, there are people have responsibilities to us. We're not just a part of nature, a plant that you can uproot. There are things you cannot do to a fetus that you cannot do to a person in a coma. And what this shows, according to the Rav, is, look, if you think that human beings are defined essentially by the fact that they have reason, well, it's interesting. Well, then what's the status of a being that looks like a human being but doesn't have reason, that is not self-conscious? You would think, well, then it's not a human being. But it is for Rav Soloveitchik, and Halacha tells us this. So this keys us into really what the Rav is trying to do, and this is where he diverges from Buber, is that the way we understand human beings completely, according to Rav Soloveitchik, is through Halacha, right? One of his names of two of his books, Halachic Man, Halachic Mind, are clear explanations of this or expressions of this idea that the complete picture of the human being is through Halacha. That's how we understand what we are, and that's how our engagement with the world is completed. That's how we achieve a full religious awareness is through Halacha, according to Rav Soloveitchik, and ultimately then that's how we achieve what we are supposed to be as human beings. So we're coming to a close of the first session. I wanted to make sure that if there are other questions, we just have a couple of minutes. But what we'll do next time, we'll try to recap, because I went through the material for Rav Soloveitchik a bit quicker than I anticipated. We'll try to do a little bit of recap and then go on to talk about the relationship between human beings and the non-human world. The third session will be about the relationship between human beings and other human beings. And then the fourth session will be about good and evil, sin and redemption. But before we break, I wanted to just ask if there are any questions or comments, reactions. Hopefully it didn't go too fast.
Well, here's one comment about the animals and the people. The structure of the animal, of the trees and different plants, is very similar to the structure of the human body itself, the circulatory system and all that kind of stuff. So you see, even in the build of it, it's got, you know, some...
And that's the commonality, right? That's why it makes sense to say that we are not simply this separate thing from the natural world. We are part of the natural world, though.
Right.
We are a unique part of the natural world.
Yeah.
I was curious about Buber's religious identity.
Well, so he was not a religious person. Jewish, yes.
Oh, yeah.
Well, he definitely discusses the idea of God. One of his books is called The Eclipse of God. But he thinks of halacha, what we would call halacha, as an attempt to create an artificial relationship with God, right? He thinks that ultimately the encounter with God has to be spontaneous, as it has to be with any other person, right? So if you try to sit down with a person and say, okay, tomorrow at 5 o'clock, we're going to talk, right? Now, maybe that'll work, but it's possible that the dialogue won't really be authentic, right? The most authentic dialogues, the most human, the dialogues you find most connection from occur spontaneously. What Buber says is where we human beings went off track in terms of our relationship to God is when we try to set up, you know, you can think about, he would say the Beis HaMikdash is an example of this. It's an attempt to define exactly how and when we are going to connect with Hashem.
Mm-hmm.
That's how Buber would see it.
So that doesn't work.
That doesn't work. That the encounter has to be spontaneous.
Exactly.
Yes, that's right. Now, that's, in a world as complicated as ours, you know, I think one of my students once said, well, look, how could you do business this way? You know, everything's supposed to just be, you know, spontaneous. So, well, that doesn't really work. So it's an interesting kind of response is that, well, this sounds great in terms of a relationship, like an emotional or, you know, non-platonic, non-business relationship. You might say, yes, that should be. If you think about how you met your spouse, right? I mean, obviously we have setups. I mean, people are set up, but there's still some dimension of that is spontaneous, which is the fact that two people say, yes, this is going to work for us. That's spontaneous. There's a thought that it might, but the actual connection, the actual encounter that leads to something more than just the first date or second date is one would hope, something spontaneous.
So that brings up the whole subject that none of these authors have touched on. That's intuition, or some form of, like you say, non-reasoning kind of connection.
Mm-hmm.
that results in spontaneity. Mm-hmm. Like, you don't just reason about a person that you
That's love. Right. Well,
you just don't evaluate them.
Right, so we haven't encountered that word yet in our discussion of Buber, mm-hmm. and I haven't read everything he's written. I don't know if he doesn't use the word or does use the word, but I think he would say, if you mean by intuition, a non-scientific attempt to understand or to think about other people or to interact, I guess, with other people, I think he'd say that's fine. I accept mm-hmm. that's the way we should. Right. What he is going to say doesn't work is the attempt to categorize people, to relate to people by categorizing them. Mm-hmm. Right. So this is a person I've got to react this way to, and I can react this way to that person based on what I'm seeing, trying to put people into categories like we would put things into categories. That he thinks is the wrong way to interact with
so
others.
So he's treating everybody the same, exactly the same.
Well, no, it's spontaneous. That's the point, right? You don't know. You don't know. That's right. And intuition is what we're calling intuition. Probably what all of us would call intuition.
It's not Bergson.
Yeah, no, it's the only thing we have to go on.
It seems to be order and some predictability and some categorization seems to be what people need. And want to feel more secure
and more comfortable.
You know, when you see somebody, you sum that person up to some extent, even though you may know that that's not all that person is. But you use the knowledge and the experience that you've had from life, and I think it seems to be what people need.
But we often find that we're surprised by what people will do.
Yeah.
Right, so it's sometimes, you know, in surprised in not a good way, and sometimes in a good way. Mm. When we think we know somebody, you know, and those are often the moments, right, that, you know, you surprise someone with doing something, you know, just absolutely wonderful and unbelievable, and the person says, wow, I never would have thought that. You know, just when I think I know you, you do something, and sometimes that's said in a negative way. You know, just when I think I've seen the lowest you can go, you know, you go lower than that even. Hopefully that's not...
It's like learned behavior. If you're in the same situation multiple times, you expect the same result. But again, insanity, I guess the definition of insanity is going through the same thing, expecting different results. Or, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, doing the same thing again and again, expecting a different result. Yeah.
Right. So.
Well, thanks everyone, and we'll meet again next Sunday at 8:00.